This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Most of us have been exposed to medical radiation through dental x-rays, CT scans, or cancer therapy. But my guest, Walt Bogdanich, has found that while this new technology saves countless lives, its complexity has created new avenues for error through software flaws, faulty programming, poor safety procedures, or inadequate staffing and training. And he says when those errors occur, they can be crippling. He's been writing a series of investigative articles on medical radiation for the New York Times. His series, The Radiation Boom, was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's won 3 Pulitzers. Walt Bogdanich, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you start looking into radiation medicine and instances of over-radiation?
Well, about 2 years ago, I got a tip from a major New York hospital that babies were being seriously over-radiated. And I think what really caught my interest, other than the obvious fact that babies shouldn't be over-radiated, nor anyone else for that matter, but that it had been going on for some time. And that told me that there was not proper oversight within the hospital and, you know, not proper oversight by the state government, which was tasked with making sure that radiation is safe. So that indicated to me that there was perhaps a systemic problem, and that if it was in fact happening at this New York hospital, it probably was happening elsewhere.
And it was not only happening with babies, it was happening with adults and children.
Yes, correct.
And the babies you found, a lot of these babies that were getting full body x-ray scans were supposed to just be getting chest x-rays.
They were premature babies, and because of that fact, their lungs were undeveloped, and they had routinely been assigned to go get chest x-rays. And what I had discovered is that rather than protect the parts of the body that were not being examined, I guess because it was quicker, these babies were just being shoved in and their entire bodies were being irradiated, including their reproductive organs, which is a very, very radiosensitive part of the body. In fact, children are far more sensitive to radiation than adults, so there were several problems here.
What happened with the babies? Do you know if they got sick?
Well, we couldn't identify them, and they wouldn't disclose it. But our stories did prompt the state to do an investigation. And the state found that the problems had continued even after we had reported them. And that's where it stands right now. At some point, I suppose there'll be some discipline imposed, but it was quite surprising to us and frankly to the state that after these serious issues were laid out on the front page of the New York Times that the people involved in the radiology department were continuing to make mistakes.
Let's just rule out some procedures that aren't radiation. Ultrasound?
Ultrasound and MRI are procedures that you really don't have to worry about in terms of radiation. MRIs, I thought for a while, involved radiation quite a few years ago, but they don't. And those are alternatives to CT scans. There are issues with sonograms, but not from a radiation perspective.
PET scans?
Well, PET scan involves radiation. I mean, that's PET scan involves actually injecting radioactive materials into your body so you can more clearly get internal pictures. So that does involve quite a bit of radiation, as a matter of fact.
Before we talk more about what you found and what you think the implications are, I don't want to terrify people because, as you point out in the series, serious accidents are rare and radiation saves countless lives. So just put this in perspective for us before we go any further.
Well, that's really important. And I was aware of that as I prepared these stories. I was very concerned because I did not want people to forego getting treatment or diagnostic imaging that they needed to make their lives safer. So I tried to put it in perspective. I mean, this new medical technology is wonderful. It diagnoses internal problems where in the past it would have required exploratory surgery. Now you don't need to open up the body. And because of the increased power and precision of radiation therapy, doctors are able to treat disease in completely new ways, more effective ways, in shorter periods of time without having to go in necessarily and cut out that that cancer that they're attacking. So I think we made it clear that these are wonderful gadgets, devices that save countless lives, and people need to get them when they need them, but they need to ask questions. And that was a big part of our series, that people were not asking questions. And frankly, doctors who treated the patients were not giving patients the kind of information they needed when they were offering their bodies up to be tested or treated.
We'll get back to that a little bit later, but let's talk about some of the things that you've found so far in your series. Let's start with one woman, a 32-year-old breast cancer patient. Radiation burned a hole in her chest. I mean, she could see her ribs. She ended up dying. What happened? What was the radiation problem?
Well, surprisingly, she began her treatment regimen on the day that the state of New York had issued a reminder to hospitals to be very, very careful with this particular type of radiation therapy, that there had been mistakes in the past and to make sure you double-checked everything. On the very day that that warning arrived, this hospital began to administer 27 straight radiation treatments, each of which was three times what it should have been. And even more striking was the fact that on the console, it was the mistake should have been obvious to the operators, that the proper radiation was not being delivered. And yet that was ignored 27 days in a row.
And what kind of radiation was this?
Well, it's radiation therapy. It's a type of device where you generate machine-generated radiation, very high-powered, that is delivered very precisely to a small area. That's a different kind of radiation than radioactive isotopes, which are not generated by machines, obviously, and in fact are regulated by two different agencies. So this is one of the high-tech devices that has, in fact, saved many people, but when it's used improperly and in a hurry without proper training, bad things happen.
So I imagine that the woman who had the hole burned in her chest from radiation had repeated exposure to, you know, had repeated radiation therapy. How could it be that nobody noticed, even as her skin was getting more and more burned and the wound getting deeper?
Well, that's a good question. I think it goes to the heart of why I was doing these stories, because there wasn't an awareness, not only among patients but among physicians, as to the harm that can result from radiation. When there's a botched surgery, you notice it right away. When there are bad drugs that are causing serious harm, you pretty much know it. But with radiation, there wasn't that ability to quickly identify the reason that perhaps skin was reddening. There was a belief, and as I discovered in my investigation, that a lot of these adverse results were pretty much written off as just, you know, part of what happens when you administer radiation. And no one looked at it as though we had made a mistake, or no one looked at it asking, could we have done better? Too often it was just dismissed as, well, you know, nothing is without risk, and surgery is not without risk, and drug therapy is not without risk. So there weren't the kinds of questions that were being asked in the aftermath of, in this case, with this poor woman, when she was suffering very serious skin damage. The questions weren't being asked, why?
So is this a one-off, or did you find that this was a pattern?
Unfortunately, it was going on all around the country. And one of the great difficulties in trying to establish scope, which is important for investigative reporters to do, because we don't want to be accused of just cherry-picking a couple of bad cases. We have to convince ourselves and convince our readers that this is some kind of systemic problem and that it's just not a collection of anecdotes. And that was very difficult to do for a number of reasons, mostly because many states do not require that accidents be reported. And there is no central place where you know, different kinds of radiation accidents are reported. And as a result, we really don't know when they happen. And again, radiation harm manifests itself in a different way than medication errors or surgery errors. I mean, the harm that can result from radiation, obviously, is cancer, and that might take a couple decades to manifest itself. Now, in radiation therapy, where there's intense radiation being applied, there are skin problems and in some cases, wounds that will not heal because the radiation literally kills the cells and they can't grow back. And that happens sometimes several weeks afterwards. And general practitioners don't recognize that as being a radiation injury. And people are not trained really to identify them. So a lot of these accidents go unreported, undetected, and when that happens, mistakes continue.
There's another example of a mistake that you found that had dire consequences. And there were several patients who had had CT scans, and this is a form of radiation scan for strokes. And they were having problems, and several of them showed up with the exact same pattern of hair loss, like a circle around their head, around the centers of their head that were like a strip around the head that was bald. And so there was hair above it and hair below it. And it's as if somebody just put a band around the center of their heads and stripped all the hair off of it.
What is amazing about that case is that there were hundreds and hundreds of instances where that occurred. And they continued for more than a year in more than one location. And these kinds of bald patterns, where it's as though you took a razor and a ruler and a perfectly straight line, shaved the head, well, that doesn't occur in nature. I mean, that's not how one loses their hair. And what was amazing to me, and frankly spoke volumes about our inability to recognize radiation injuries, is that this went on over and over and over again, and doctors saw this, and for some reason never thought to ask or didn't pursue it, didn't ask the patient, well, recently did you have some kind of medical procedure on your head? That would seem to be a very obvious question. And when the person obviously answered yes, well, it would seem that that ought to be pursued. And for some reason, it wasn't. And as a result, hundreds and hundreds of patients around the country were seriously over-radiated and are suffering ill effects to this day.
So is there like a band that's put on the head for this kind of CT scan that matches the pattern of baldness?
Pretty much, exactly. It's where the radiation went in, and when it's high enough, it kills the hair cells and follicles. And it did it in straight lines around the head, and understandably, people who were subjected to this were quite worried. They would go take a shower, and all of a sudden, there would be huge gobs of hair in the bathtub. And they would, in a panic, go talk to the doctor and say, what's going on? And most frequently, they were told, well, you must have some alopecia or some kind of skin ailment that will come and go and we'll give you some cream. I mean, one person who had it was given some kind of other therapy to try and make the hair grow again, when in fact what had caused it was serious cases of over-radiation.
So what went wrong in this instance?
Well, the operators, quite honestly, did not understand how to use these very high-tech radiation devices. Hospitals are they want more patients, understandably. And as soon as a new gee whiz medical device comes out that is some life-saving device, and there are many of them, and praise to the people who are producing them, but every hospital wants to get them as quickly as possible, and sometimes they move too quickly. They buy them, they install them, they don't spend the kind of money necessary to properly train the staff in its use and to develop the kind of protocols necessary to ensure that mistakes don't happen. Now, mistakes will always happen. I mean, they happen in journalism, they happen in every profession. The idea is, how can we devise a system where we will minimize the possibility of that? And that wasn't happening. And that was a part of the issue that we were looking into.
There's another type of radiation medicine problem I want to ask you about, and that's dental x-rays, particularly children's dental x-rays. What's the problem you found?
What I found is that people do not realize the levels of radiation that are being administered to their children. And they don't realize the children are, their children are more vulnerable to the harmful effects of radiation. And like most parents, and I'm one of them, it had never occurred to me that there might be excess radiation being administered in a dental office. I was always under the impression that, and under the impression because dentists told me this, you don't worry about it. Every time you came in to have your teeth checked, you were given x-rays. And everyone told me it was the lowest amount of any medical procedure, and I believed them. And in some cases, that's true. But what I discovered in other cases, it's not. And that is because of new technology that had been administered, that had been developed, and was increasingly being used on young adults who are getting braces, orthodontic care. And there is this device called a cone beam CT scan. It's not as powerful as the CT scans that are in hospitals or clinics that, you know, may be looking inside one's body, but they are more powerful than the typical x-rays that you would get in a dentist's office. And what struck me in merited further investigation is that when sources told me that parents are given the option of having pictures taken of their child's mouth before they get braces, of having a cone beam CT scan, which administers a significant amount of radiation, or having their child, you know, merely have pictures taken of their mouth, regular pictures that don't use radiation. So you have an option of radiation on one hand or no radiation on the other hand. Now, the radiation produces these incredible, brilliant 3D pictures, but dentists tell me that that's not always necessary. There are also adequate images that can be put together in 3D form by simply taking pictures within the mouth. Well, you know, that here was a clear-cut case of I thought, and many of the experts that I interviewed thought as well, there was no need to subject, you know, young adults to these levels of radiation. And it was an interesting question to try and figure out why.
So you say that children are more vulnerable to radiation than adults. Why is that?
A couple of reasons why it's more dangerous for children. One, their cells are dividing and they're more vulnerable. Second of all, children face a lifetime of radiation procedures, some of which haven't even been developed yet, but as technology marches forward, we know they will be. And there's a strong belief, consensus in the medical community that the harmful effects of radiation are cumulative. And what that means is the more radiation you receive in your lifetime, the greater the likelihood that you'll develop cancer. So particularly with children, you don't want to get them started on a path where you're over-radiating them, particularly when it's not necessary.
Now, children and adults get regular dental x-rays, and a lot of dentists have new digital x-ray machines. Are the digital x-rays, do they emit less radiation than the old films do?
Digital imaging does produce less radiation. But as I learned in investigating dental x-rays, I found that there is even a wide difference in the more traditional film imaging of dental, of your dental structure, that the kind we're all familiar with when we go in and we have our teeth examined, and they take these quick pictures. Most doctors, according to the FDA, doctors should be using digital imaging, but instead they're sticking with the old film. And there are two different speeds of film developing, and a lot of doctors are using the slower film, which means that you are exposed for a greater period of time to the radiation. If they were using faster speed film, it would be a shorter period. I also found that doctors were using improper developing techniques for that film once the images were taken, and which required them to expose the patient longer, for longer periods of time in order to get a clearer image, because you couldn't get a clearer image with the bad developing techniques that were being used. So there were a whole host of problems that existed in dental radiation that were rarely written about.
So what are some of the questions you think people should ask their dentists about themselves or their children?
Well, is this imaging exam that you're talking about necessary? Is it necessary for me every 6 months when I come in to have my teeth cleaned to have x-rays? I think everyone should ask what speed film the dentist is using. And every patient should ask, why are you not using digital? And particularly for young adults who are about to have braces put on, is it really necessary for me to have this cone beam CT scan, or is there a way for you to get the images you need to make sure that I get the proper braces put on without using as much radiation? Those are the kinds of questions really that we should be asking for any kind of radiological procedure.
So when you ask your dentist if you really need the six-month x-rays, doesn't your dentist say, yes, you do?
In fact, that's what I was told about 5 months ago. And I said, well, actually, I don't think I need it because I don't have a history of cavities and I have good dental hygiene. Now, that may be required for people with poor dental hygiene and are more prone to cavities, but I hadn't had a cavity in years despite all of these exams that I had been having. You know, please tell me why I need this procedure, be it a dental x-ray, be it a CT scan, be it a chest x-ray. Every bit of it, there has to be a need for it. Otherwise, you have no benefit and only risk.
But I feel it's our responsibility to say here, there often is a really good reason why you need it, and if you need it, get it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like
absolutely.
We need to keep repeating that.
and we should. And I went to great pains in my stories at the top of the story to talk about how valuable this is. I mean, it is amazing technology. To see these 3D images of the mouth or 3D images of the body and to realize how much medicine has advanced and how you no longer have to cut the body open to find out what's going on inside. That's fabulous. And also the ability to treat cancer and to kill cancer cells without having to cut it out, and to do so with incredible precision and accuracy in fewer treatments. So that's great information, and hats off to all the people responsible for that. I guess, you know, one question that has been asked of me, why are you just reporting on the negative side of things? And, I tried to point out the positive side of it, but I felt that hospitals and manufacturers and of this equipment were doing quite a good job of promoting it and selling it to patients. And all you have to do is turn on the radio and listen to this hospital or that hospital talking about the new radiation therapy equipment that it's got. So I felt it was time for people to stop and have a time out and realize that this is nothing to be taken lightly. It is a time to ask questions and not be afraid to ask those questions.
So what is the regulatory environment for radiation medicine?
Well, it's very spotty, and that is one of the problems. The responsibility for ensuring the safe delivery of radiation therapy or diagnostic radiation lies in many different agencies. And each of those agencies have different requirements, different standards. One state, Texas, requires that errors be reported, but it doesn't have the authority to punish or to discipline the people who make those errors. Other states don't require that errors be reported at all. Then you have the Food and Drug Administration. Its responsibility is on the devices themselves, but not how they are used. And what I discovered is that the operators, for instance, who are in some states not credentialed. They don't have to be meet any kind of educational standards. They don't have to be licensed. They don't know how to use the machines properly. And when that happens, people are harmed.
And you also found that licensing of radiation technologists is a state-by-state affair, and some states have no licensing requirements at all.
That's correct. And for 10 years now, there has been movement in Congress to try and pass a bill. The acronym is the CARE Bill, which would require some kind of uniform licensing of key medical personnel involved in administering radiation. And there are quite a few professions involved, many of whom are not licensed at all. And yet, after 10 years of debate and bipartisan support, it has not become law, much to the amazement of leadership in the field, because I did a report on that, and I frankly couldn't find anyone who didn't want that bill to pass. I guess it just came down to the fact that the members of Congress felt that there were more important issues to deal with. And as a result, that bill is still languishing, as they say, in the halls of Congress, and operators continue to perform these very complex procedures without having to meet any specific requirements.
So if you're having radiation treatment for cancer, for instance, the person who's actually aiming the radiation beam and, you know, turning it on and off and setting up the controls for the equipment, is that a technologist who may or may not be licensed?
That's correct. That's correct. But as I said earlier, there are a number of different professions involved in the actual administration of radiation therapy. I think one of the most critical professions is a group of people called medical physicists, and it's their job to calculate, come up with the algorithms, and plug in a ton of numbers, and figure out how to most safely deliver this radiation in a precise manner, in the way that the oncologist has prescribed. And that's no easy matter. So you start with the oncologist, who comes up with a recommendation for what he or she wants done. Then you have the medical physicist, who, in conjunction with the oncologist, devises some complicated medical plan with the help of computers, which can take hours sometimes for even these very fast computers to come up with the proper treatment plan. And then it's passed on to the operators, who are actually responsible for, you know, pressing the buttons and turning the dials.
So what are you supposed to do, say, to the radiation therapist or radiation technologist who's working with you? Excuse me, are you licensed? Excuse me, do you actually know what you're doing? I mean, how do you know if the person is adequately trained, if they're really paying attention, if they know what they're doing, if you're getting what you're supposed to get?
Those are all good questions, but I frankly wouldn't ask the operator. I would start with the oncologist, the doctor who has ordered this test, with whom you have a relationship or should have a relationship. And that doctor ought to be able to answer those questions. Among them, is this facility accredited to do radiation therapy? Is there a professional organization that's accrediting it in the absence of any kind of effective government oversight? At least there are reputable professional groups that will accredit these units, and that should be asked. And I think it's fair to ask, are the operators of this device, when I'm lying down on that machine in this very powerful radiation-generating device is aimed at my body, I want to know that that operator has been properly trained and credentialed. Can you assure me that he or she is? And that's really all you can do. I think a lot of people are afraid to ask questions of their doctors because they feel they'll get worse treatment. Now, the doctor will be angry. He'll be a little snippy. But, you know, that's unfounded. I've never met a doctor who would intentionally give bad treatment to someone who irritated them by asking questions. They might be slightly irritated, yes, but I think that that puts them on a higher state of alert, and I certainly feel that way when I ask the questions and now. And I think that's a good thing because a higher state of alert is where they ought to be. Every procedure is serious, and it should not be routine.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walt Bogdanich. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and we're talking about his series Radiation Boom, which is about how new radiation medical therapies have not only created new cures, they've created new ways of doing harm. So, like, what would you recommend to somebody listening to you now who is about to start radiation therapy for cancer?
Well, I would make sure that this is a top-flight institution that's providing it. There's no need for every hospital in the country to provide high-tech radiation therapy treatment. It simply makes no sense, financially or from a safety perspective. I want to go to a hospital that does it, has done it for a considerable amount of time, has a good reputation for doing it, and does it often. And I will research, as I mean, I may have a leg up on a typical patient, but I'll research the doctor, go out on Google, find out what kind of problems the doctor may have had, maybe check lawsuits. That's no guarantee. But nonetheless, you know, I think you just have to ask questions, the kind we talked about earlier in the program. You know, is this facility accredited? You know, how many of these procedures do you do? Are the operators, the technicians, are they credentialed? Are they licensed? Is it necessary? You know, that's another question. Because there is a great deal of evidence that some of these procedures are performed when there really isn't a necessity for it. And one area that commonly happens in is in prostate cancer treatments, where sometimes the wise course is to watch and wait. But when you have, you know, you've just spent all this money on these high-tech devices, there's an incentive to use it. And sometimes it's used inappropriately and in cases where it's not necessary.
So, you know, in reading your series and in talking with you, one of the things I've been thinking about is that I have absolutely no idea how much cumulative radiation I have gotten over the years in terms of, you know, mammograms and chest x-rays and in x-rays after falls and things like that, scans. I just have absolutely no idea.
Nobody does. You have highlighted, I think, the biggest problem right now that needs to be addressed. And people, fortunately, as a result of my stories and other concerns expressed in the profession, they're now talking about ways to make sure that individual patients on their records, this radiation exposure is recorded. And so when you go from one doctor to another doctor, move from one city to another city, this type of information goes with you. But there are problems that have to be worked out before that can work. Unfortunately, there are many different ways to measure radiation exposure. And there are debates in the field that go on, well, here's one way, here's another way. In fact, there are different ways to even identify doses in radiation. Different terminology is used, grays or millisieverts. So there has to be some kind of uniformity of collecting this data and measuring it so that it becomes meaningful. But I think you've hit on a really important point. And quite honestly, the medical profession recognizes it too. We need to find a way to measure the cumulative doses that we each receive as we go through life and experience the inevitable, you know, X-ray procedures and illnesses. And it's important to know that.
Well, I wish you good health.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Walt Bogdanich is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. You'll find links to the articles in his series, The Radiation Boom, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward considers Neil Diamond's early years. His earliest recordings are collected on a recent CD. This is Fresh Air. Neil Diamond has sold more than 125 million records, written and recorded 36 top 40 songs, and has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, as well as the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Still, he had to start somewhere, and that somewhere was the legendary Brill Building, where he wrote songs for music publishers. With the release of Diamond's earliest recordings, plus a CD of his music performed by others, rock historian Ed Ward takes a look at his early days.
I thought love was only true in fairy tale, meant for someone else but not for me. Love was out to get me, that's the way it seemed. Disappointing, haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace. Doubt my mind. I'm in love. And I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. I thought love.
Probably the strongest negative reaction I've ever gotten to anything I've written was when I panned a Neil Diamond show during my stint at Austin's Daily Newspaper. His fan club newsletter picked it up, and for 2.5 years we got letters denouncing me, the last of which came from Vanuatu in the South Pacific. But my disappointment in the show was based on remembering where Diamond had come from. Diamond was born in Brooklyn to immigrant parents in 1941 and got a guitar for his 16th birthday. Almost immediately he started writing songs and performing them with a neighbor. He went from one unsuccessful record contract to another, from the most obscure to a one-single deal with Columbia. Next came a songwriting contract with Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, which kept him fed, but produced only 6 songs in 1 year. He'd been mentored by the great songwriting team of Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich after Greenwich sang backup on a demo he'd cut. And after getting fired from Lieber and Stoller, he asked Barry and Greenwich if they'd take a chance on him. At that point, something happened.
Baby, love me. All the girls outside, yeah. Said she loved me, yes, yes, she does. Gonna show me tonight, yeah. She got the way to move me, cherry.
She got the way to move me. She got the way to move me,
cherry, baby.
She got the way.
Barry and Greenwich scored him a deal with Burt Burns' new label, Bang, and his second single, Cherry Cherry, wound up in the top 10 in 1966. Suddenly, he was writing more than he could record, so Talleyrand Music, the company Barry and Greenwich had set up with him, was placing his songs all over the place.
Red, red.
Red Red Wine, for instance, found its way to the Jamaican expat community in London, where a guy named Jimmy James recorded it, only to be scooped by Tony Tribe, who put a reggae beat to it. 25 years later, the British band UB40 recorded it on an album of the songs they'd grown up with, released it as a single, and topped the British charts and eventually many others, too, over an amazing 2-year period. There was no doubt he was hot. The Monkees' version of I'm a Believer was 1967's top-selling song, and so it was no surprise when the Box Tops, led by Alex Chilton, chose a song of his to record the next year. Still, Diamond was determined to have his own career and worked hard at it, even if he too sometimes recorded excellent versions of other people's songs.
Monday, Monday, so good to you.
Things at Bang were untenable. Bang's view of who he was and his own idea were at odds with each other, and when he and the label locked horns over what his next single should be, it resulted in a lawsuit for ownership of his recordings, which went all the way to the Supreme Court, which found in his favor in 1977. Burt Burns, the label's head, had died during the course of it all, and by early 1968, Neil Diamond had signed to another label and was on his way to superstardom.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. The early Neil Diamond recordings he played are on the album Neil Diamond, The Bang Years, 1966 to 1968. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. We want to give a shout to listeners in Houston and to public radio station KUHF, which started carrying Fresh Air today as part of its newly launched news and information schedule. We're glad to be with you. Fresh Air's executive producer is Yanni Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Melinda was mine till the time that I found her holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong, that's what I thought. Me and Sue, that I do. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl to stay and won't play games behind me, but I'll be what I am. Part-time thing, paper ring. I know it's been done, having one girl who loves you, right or wrong, we go strong.